Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and today I'm joined by our Editor-at-Large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
And our Contributing Editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Jack Shepherd will also be popping in with his chat with a couple of actors, so it's all the J's this week. So this week we're chatting to Gary Oldman and Lily Collins about David Fincher's Mank, as well as Viggo Mortensen and Lance Henriksen about their new film Falling. Plus we're taking a look at Cordelia, Host, County Lines and Crock of Gold. So that's a lot to get through. Also this week we found out that Wonder Woman will be appearing in cinemas as well as online, so that's exciting. We'll be reviewing that in a later pod. But for now, shall we crack on? Let's look at this. It's our current cover movie.
Hello, everyone.
Make yourself to home, Mr. Mankiewicz, or shall I call you Herman?
Please, call me Mank.
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 This is Herman Mankiewicz, but we're to call him Mank.
Mankiewicz. Herman Mankiewicz, New York playwright and drama critic.
Turned humble screenwriter, Mr. Hearst.
This is a business where the buyer gets nothing for his money but a memory. What he bought still belongs to the man who sold it. That's the real magic of the movies.
Thunder, lightning, blood, fire, religion.
Help! Someone save me!
All in one film.
That's director-proof.
That's why I always want Mank around.
This is David Fincher's love letter to the golden age of Hollywood, tracking self-destructive alcoholic screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz as he rails against the studio system and Orson Welles during the writing of Citizen Kane. Written by Fincher's father Jack and filmed in black and white with period-appropriate sound and styling, it's received rave reviews across the board and could be another Netflix awards magnet. Before we find out if it's a five-starer from us, let's take a listen to our Hollywood correspondent Adam Tanswell as he talks to the man playing Mank, Gary Oldman.
Hello, Mr. Oldman, and thank you. You're the cover of Total Film this month.
I saw that. It's reminiscent of the Orson Welles poster.
Thank you. Listen, we've got limited time with you today, but after making The Darkest Hour, did you have any reservations about taking on another real-life person? And in what way do you relate to this man that helped your portrayal in this movie?
You know, it's that old thing of never say never. I didn't really think about it. I mean, the advantage of it is that he's not as iconic. You know, Churchill had its own challenges because he means so many different things to so many people. And just the silhouette alone is so famous. That presented challenges in itself. With Mank, the script was glorious. I've known David for nearly 20 years, but had never ticked that box. So when he said, you know, the backdrop of this is, you know, the real golden age of Hollywood, it's in black and white, I'm going to do ribbon sound, I'm going to do this and that, and the script was wonderful and the role was just sensational. I never really thought, oh, it's another famous person. And I knew more about Joseph because of this, you know, incredible career that he had. When our movie ends, he then goes on to have this incredible career. So what I knew really about Herman, I could have put on a postage stamp, you know. The cinephiles out there will know they're Herman. So in that respect, it felt like a safe bet. It felt more like a fictional character, in fact.
And in what ways do you relate to the man that helped you in this portrayal?
This was a big challenge. There's a lot going on with Mank. Orson Welles said that he was a monument to self-destruction, and that he was charming and funny and the most wonderful company, and adored him and loved him. The sad thing is he went to Victorville and they were best friends. And when he came back from Victorville, they were enemies. There's a lot of self-loathing going on, I think. So the challenge was you're playing a writer, you know, or playing a mountain climber or an aviator. You're playing a writer, which is tough. And you're playing a writer who is in bed. You know, you have to sort of make that interesting. And with all that self-destruction going on, you've got to make him charming. He might not like himself very much, but you've got to make the audience like him. You know, it's no secret I'm a recovering alcoholic. And thank God, you know, it's nearly 24 years. It's a long time ago now. But I remember. I remember what that was like. And that alcoholic thinking. That's the thing. When you're playing a drunk, you don't necessarily have to be physically drinking or drunk to be a drunk, because it informs the thinking and the behavior, which I thought was really wonderfully captured in the writing. Any of the reading that I did outside of the material and the sense of Mank that I got from books or anecdotes or really very much matched the man that was on the page. So I think Jack did incredible research because I felt that I didn't have to really travel very far outside the sort of framework of the script.
That's Gary Oldman talking about Mank. And Adam also talked to Lily Collins, who's playing Mank's long-suffering British secretary, Rita Alexander. Here's what she had to say about playing a real-life person.
Gary Oldman talked about how the cast looked at various movies from the era. Apart from the obvious, what movies did you look at? Were you given a list or did you sort of research independently?
I wasn't actually given a list. I was shooting in Paris for Emily in Paris at the same time, and I was flying back twice for 24 hours for rehearsals and tests and meetings with David and Gary. And David referenced a lot of films that I would go watch clips from. There was so many at that point, but my brain was all over the place with Emily that I was kind of going back and forth. I think, like you said, the obvious, rewatching Citizen Kane. But for me as Rita, her being a real life character, a real life woman, but there was very little research to be done on her. I rested upon doing research of women at that time in England, as well as in America, creating this character who felt true to the essence of who Rita was. And then I loved working with Gary because he just brought something different out of my character every single day. And so it was unlike playing someone like Marion Davies, who you could literally probably watch all her movies and try to get more of who she was from that. I didn't really have that. And so I love old Hollywood anyway. I love black and white movies. I love that era of Hollywood. And so just to feel a part of it in that way and be surrounded by these incredible actors who were real people that I could research and do reading up on Mankiewicz. It was strange because I was real, but there was very little research to be done. So I was in that limbo period of kind of creating as well as resting on what I could find.
And when it comes to the golden age of Hollywood, what movie can you watch over and over again?
I love all of Alfred Hitchcock's movies. Having just had Halloween, it's like you could watch The Birds or any of those films so many times. And I actually have watched Citizen Kane quite a few times because I studied old Hollywood and film in my high school. So in my acting classes, which was amazing. I love all of Audrey Hepburn's movies, Funny Face, all of those films.
Tell us, what are your very first memories of Hollywood?
I moved here when I was 5, turning 6, and I remember driving down Sunset Boulevard with the palm trees and asking if we could just stay because I was moving from England. And I just was so captivated by the essence here of LA and seeing the Hollywood sign. And I even visited Hearst Castle when I was younger with my mom. Little did I know that one day, you know, I'd be doing a movie that focused so heavily on that. My mom was born and raised in LA, and there's just something, as British as I feel, there's like a real familial quality to me that is LA and Hollywood. And I'm kind of this dual citizen, literally, and I just feel so at home.
Okay, so that's Gary and Lily talking about Mank, and obviously Gary very appreciative of our cover, looking like Citizen Kane. What did you make of this, Jamie? I know that you were very excited to see this as a huge fan of Citizen Kane. What did you make of it?
I thought it was absolutely great. The thing I really like about it is, as a fan of Citizen Kane, I've seen that film many times, I've read books about it, I've kind of researched it. But this film sort of took me places I didn't expect and introduced me to backstories I didn't know about, particularly with William Randolph Hearst, who, of course, was the newspaper magnate who was the real-life person that Citizen Kane is based on. It sort of took you into the fact that he very much pioneered fake news and kind of had a big effect on the 1934 Californian election and kind of all the politics behind it, which is maybe the reason that Herman J. Mankiewicz, who's our hero in this film, the screenwriter played by Gary Oldman, why he kind of took William Randolph Hearst to task in this film in Citizen Kane and made a film that is a real kind of takedown of him in a way. And I didn't know that side of it, so I found that particularly fascinating. Even if you don't know Citizen Kane, even if you haven't watched it yet and you just know of it as the greatest film ever made, you know, which is always called,
always tops the list, doesn't
always
it?
You can still very much enjoy this film. I mean, if you do know Citizen Kane, you'll maybe get a few extra layers and a few little in jokes here and there, But if you've never seen Citizen Kane, this still works very much as a character piece, a study of a man, about authorship, about self-loathing, fear of failure, value of the written word, and very much it works as a film inside Hollywood and the machinations of Hollywood and how it works and the politics of it all. It's really fascinating. Like, Jack Fincher wrote it, as you said, who is David Fincher's father. But David Fincher has very much brought his own experiences to play as well. The fact that he's been working in Hollywood since the kind of mid-90s and he knows it inside out. And it feels like a real insider's job. You know, I think it's a wonderful film.
What about you, James? Love it?
Yeah, absolutely. Just to see another David Fincher film after, I think, 6-7 years since Gone Girl, I think it was the last one. As much as it is about Citizen Kane, it's also not, because it is set several years ahead of that film being made. And I think, to me, I got it in my head before I watched it, it was going to be about Citizen Kane, and it's really not. It's really about Mankiewicz. And you see movies about the making of other films, that's not unusual, but you don't often see a film about the making of a script, if you like, and that's what this is. That's very unusual. To try and dramatize that is very difficult as well.
Yeah, and to make it like thrilling and so dramatic, basically a man dictating to a secretary a screenplay, it's quite an achievement.
While in bed, ill.
While in bed, yes, whilst drinking. I agree with both of you. I think it's a beautiful film and real sort of movie porn for anyone that has sort of grown up watching those black and white movies on BBC Two after school like I did. It sort of really takes you into that world. But yeah, as you say, it does have a lot of things to say that are parallel with, you know, the current world. It's not just something that's a foisty, dusty old thing from the past, is it? It does have parallels with, you know, the political system we are currently looking at. It also has a lot to say about the role of women and, you know, whether they are decoration only, as in the case of Marion Davies. And also, as you say, Jamie, this idea of authorship and the power of words and the power of drama to shine a light on real things, which is what Mankiewicz is sort of trying to do. But also, again, as Gary said in his chat there, there's this really sort of harsh look at alcoholism and the dreadful impact it has on not only the person suffering it, but the people around them, which I found really quite moving.
It's funny, actually, because if there's been one criticism of this film, and like you said, Jane, the critics have gone mad for it. They absolutely love it. But if there's been one criticism, it's been that Gary Oldman, as wonderful as he is in it, he is 62 years old and he's playing a man who is 43 years old in the film in 1940, Herman J. Mankiewicz, and even younger than that because we flash back throughout the 30s. So people say, well, you know, he's too old. Why did he cast him? Why did he cast Gary Oldman? But according to Fincher, Mankiewicz was, you know, he's such an alcoholic and he'd drunk so heavily throughout his life that even though he was 43 years old, if you look at pictures of him then, he did look in his mid to late 50s. So it kind of works that
way as
well.
Googles furiously now. Googled
furiously. Yes, exactly. So yeah, it kind of works. And maybe you need a bit of back knowledge to get that. Maybe the casual viewer would just go, well, I can't buy him, like, because Gary Oldman says at one point, like, I'm 43 or something like that. And the casual viewer may think, no, you're not. You're like late 50s, early 60s, but it does work. So a great performance by Oldman. You know, he won his Oscar a few years ago for Darkest Hour playing Winston Churchill, but this to me is a far superior performance and a lot more sort of stripped back without the makeup and all of that. It's just a man and his ghosts and his neuroses, you know, really effective.
But let's talk about the women, because it's not just all guys in suits in this. There's some really compelling women in this. Namely, Amanda Seyfried playing Marion Davies. What did you make of her? There's talk of, you know, awards for her.
I think she's fantastic in the film. I mean, I think there's really three very strong female performances. Of course, there's her. You mentioned, you know, we've just heard Lily as Rita Alexander. And then there's Tuppence Middleton as well as Sarah Mankiewicz's wife, kind of long-suffering wife. And that's one thing I really liked about the film that really surprised me is, much as it's about him, it's also about these three women that are kind of revolving in his orbit. And I mean, particularly strong, as you just said, Amanda is incredible in the film. Richly would deserve any award coming her way, I think. I mean, she really just looks like she's been ripped out of the 1930s and just plonked into this movie. It's, you know, it's an incredible performance.
The other thing with her in this role is she's playing Marion Davis, the actress who was obviously William Randolph Hearst's mistress, young lover, and is Susan Alexander, if you know Citizen Kane, the kind of send-up of a talentless opera singer. Susan Alexander is based on Marion Davis. So I was expecting it to be quite a cartoonish performance and a sort of send-up of Marion Davis, but what Amanda Seyfried brings is great depth and complexity and nuance to it that, you know, she's not an easy character. You actually really feel for her. She's got a lovely friendship with Mankiewicz, even though he kind of uses it and puts it into this screenplay in a quite nasty way, in a way. But, you know, it's a really layered performance and really rich.
Yeah, in fact, she feels like the one that really has got what the hell's going on. And actually, everyone else are the fools around her, to be honest. There's a particular scene where she sat in Hearst Castle at a party and sort of sitting on the sofa in this amazing outfit. And it does just feel like she's in on the joke and nobody else is. She feels really wise, actually. And I really enjoyed that about her. She's not just the dumb starlet.
Got to give a shout out to Arliss Howard as well, who plays Louis B. Mayer, the sort of studio mogul. I mean, there's actually a number of smaller roles where you see the likes of David O. Selznick, for example, sort of popping up, Irvin Thalberg. I mean, Arliss Howard, who everyone will know from Full Metal Jacket years ago, is absolutely masterful in this film. And kind of, again, small scenes, but really everyone makes everything count in this film.
The one other thing I'd say just quickly is you may think, oh, black and white film, you know, about the making of Citizen Kane's script, you know, it's going to be boring, it's going to be dusty. But the other thing that should be said is Herman J. Mankiewicz really was a once in a generation wit. He's one of those guys who always had a comeback, a sharp one-liner. And this film is so funny. You know, you watch it and there's so many lines that just make you chuckle out loud. So it's a real pleasure to watch.
So I think we're really highly recommending, and we are giving that our gold star recommendation. It is on Netflix, so anyone can see it as well, which is also fantastic. It was supposed to be in cinemas, but obviously something called COVID put the kibosh on that. So it is available on Netflix from tomorrow. So do mix yourself a vodka martini and watch it, darling. It's terribly, terribly good. Okay, so from one man's personal struggle to another, shall we take a look at this?
How was your trip out here, Daddy?
Who cares?
You asked me to come get you. Remember?
I would never say that. Doctor,
doctor. Dad, you know Mom's not here. Father,
Mom. Did you forget because you're too old?
So that's Falling, a film written and directed by Viggo Mortensen and based on his own experiences. And it's about a man whose father, played by Lance Henriksen, shows signs of dementia. So he brings him to live with him. But the two men clash, and can they find an understanding? Before we talk about the film, here's what Viggo and Lance had to say about making this challenging project when Jack Shepherd sat down with them and asked Viggo what it was like to make a film that was so personal to him.
In this movie story, a lot of the more complex scenes, emotionally demanding, just in terms of the dialogue and the interactions. Some of the more difficult scenes were the ones that Lance and I had to perform together as actors. I wasn't just the director of those scenes, but I was in the scene on an equal footing with Lance. And because we had gotten to know each other in the years previous to shooting, because it took a long time to find the money to finally be able to shoot the movie, we had got to know each other and trust each other and share personal stories with each other. And as actors, I think that we have a similar approach in that we never want to be caught acting. You want to get to the heart of the matter, no matter what it takes, how uncomfortable the experience might be or what you're trying to portray is, in an honest way. And being that we were both in these scenes, we were having to solve those problems and overcome those obstacles together. It was difficult sometimes. It was as difficult as I thought it would be, but it was even more satisfying than I hoped it would be to work together on those complicated scenes. I really enjoyed it. And without Lance and the subtlety and the courage that he brought to his portrayal, the movie really wouldn't work in the way it does. And I think it's an extraordinary performance that Lance gives.
Thank you. I'm an actor, so I'm willing to take chances and dig into things that I wasn't expecting. The core of it was that Viggo had written this amazing script and complicated script, and he went through the whole thing with us again. He wrote it, and then now we're filming it, and he's going through it with us again. And that was an amazing support system. So we could take chances and try to come up with something, like you said, you don't want to get caught acting in a thing that's all about passion and confusion and all of those hard things to act.
There's this phenomenal like confrontation scene towards the end of this film. Is that the sort of scene you kind of crave as an artist to be part of and to do, or is it more of a draining experience?
It's draining and it's something that you want, you know, you want the challenge. Because we don't know what we're capable of until we get the challenge. We don't know. You know, we can imagine what I would like to do. I'd like to be a pirate swinging on a rope, you know, from the top. But it was a gift in every way.
An interesting thing about this is obviously for Viggo, it's your first time as a director. So I'm wondering, you know, working on something you wrote, directed, did the music, has it given you a new appreciation, a renewed appreciation of some of the other directors you've worked with in the past?
Well, I certainly benefited from what I've observed and learned working with some, I've been fortunate with really good directors, with David Cronenberg, Jane Campion, Peter Jackson, David Olhoff, and just a vast array of very talented people, men and women from different countries, different cultures, with different approaches, different tastes. And yet all of them, one way or another, prepared what they were going to do really well and communicated openly and without being insecure in a really constructive way or constructive ways with their crew, with their cast. In other words, they made the most of the opportunity that they had. And, you know, I took that on board. We prepared the movie really well because I knew we would have a short time to shoot a very ambitious story. In winter, with limited daylight hours, with lots of children who have limited work hours, different time periods, some very long scenes for movies, for any movie, very complex, difficult scenes. So preparing was important. And on the first day, as I said to the cast and crew, I said, we're going to do this together. We have one shot at it. We have one chance to make this movie. And just because I wrote this story and I have a very clear idea of what I want to attempt, it doesn't mean I have all the answers. And if you have a question or a suggestion about anything we're doing on any given day, please speak up, because a good idea can come from anyone at any time. Please don't do it the day after or the week after we've shot the scene. Now's the time. Don't be shy. I'm not going to take offense at any suggestion. We'll do this together. And that's what we did. So that is because I learned that's the best way to do it. I mean, there are certain points during the shooting, you have ups and downs. I think Lance had them too, where Lance was saying, I think this is going to be my last movie. This is kicking my ass. And I said, yeah, this has been interesting. I don't know if I'm going to direct anymore. You know, we had a low point, which we shared. It's always good to communicate. You know, and we solved the problems. And suddenly we were on fire again and happy to be doing it. But we were together and we were communicating throughout. But I have to say, there were moments and I thought, why did I write it this way? Why did I put this challenge in front of us? This is horrible. This is like, we are so uncomfortable and we're going to be uncomfortable all day trying to get there. Because if we're going to be honest, this has to be difficult for us if we want it to be difficult for the audience. That's what we have to do. But I thought, I wrote this. Why did I do that? Why are we putting ourselves through this? Why am I putting Lance through this? It was worth it, you know, but there were times it was difficult.
I remember us standing in a parking lot and the sun had set and it was cold up in Canada, freezing cold. And it matched where we felt we were at. We were just at the bottom. I don't think it can happen in a flux story. I've gotten away with a lot as an actor. I mean, I could handle a lot more than they thought I could. But in this case, because of the affection I had for Viggo and what we were attempting, I had to be honest. And I literally said, Viggo, I think I'm going to quit acting. I'm done. I don't know if I've ever felt this low in my life. You know,
we were living in Bleak House.
I know, Bleak House is right. And then he left a note in my trailer with a rose on it, a white rose. And he said, this is supposed to be fun. Tomorrow when we come in, let's have fun. And we did. We didn't have fun to the point of messing up what we needed to do, but it sure lifted us both up. I think it lifted him up to write the note, because he even said to me, I don't know, this directing thing is like, you know. But that's all looking back, you know, the pain of birth, if women really remembered everything about the pain of birth, there'd be no children, you know, but you forget. The next day you forget, you go, oh, let's plunge at this again. We know we got something, you know, we felt it. What an experience. This is a lifetime experience. This is the one I was waiting for to confirm that acting is worth doing. I mean,
that's beautiful, man.
Okay, so that was Viggo and Lance chatting about Falling. Jamie, set it up for us. Where do we meet these two in this film?
Well, essentially, Willis, who is played by Lance Henriksen, he is living in upstate New York. He's kind of rural farmer type. He's an octogenarian. And his son, John, who's middle-aged, played by Viggo Mortensen, lives in LA with his Chinese-Hawaiian husband. And he goes to pick up his father because his father is suffering from dementia and he's going to bring him home to live with them, basically, so that he can look after him. Now, the trouble is his father really wants none of it. He's a very proud, stubborn man. He doesn't want to be looked after. He doesn't want to feel that his kind of manhood is being threatened. He's very homophobic. He's misogynistic. He's xenophobic. So you can imagine he's like throwing out insults at the dinner table to his son and to his son's husband, you know, some really quite nasty things. John, played by Viggo, is trying to stay very calm and look after his father and forgiving, but he really has tested his mettle. And it's really about the relationship between those two guys and forgiveness and can they find it. And the film flashes backwards and forwards constantly between the childhood when Viggo was the young boy growing up in the household with his strict father and where they are now. And it really reflects on how the past always kind of taints the present and informs the present.
Did you like it?
I did like it. I didn't love it. I found it quite a hard watch in a good way. And, you know, it didn't for me have loads and loads of momentum. I found the structure of it flip-flopping constantly a little bit jarring. I couldn't really get into it all the time. But what I did like about it was the performances, especially Lance Henriksen. That here is a guy, I think he's 82 years old. He's been in 270 movies, mainly B-movies and genre movies. And some of them have been magnificent, like Terminator, Aliens, Near Dark. A lot of them you won't have heard of. There's a lot of dross on that CV as well. But he's never had a role like this. Here he is, 82 years old, and he's given such a meaty role to sink his teeth into. And boy, does he deliver. I mean, he's wonderful and far more layered and nuanced than we've ever seen him or he's ever had an opportunity to be before. If this film is pushed and gets a bit of a campaign behind it and a bit of money behind it, I fully expect him to get a Best Supporting Actor Oscar nomination, and deservedly so.
You say that, but I don't know about you, James. I found it very admirable and impressive to watch as a performance, but as a character, I found Willis very, very difficult to like, very difficult to sympathise with, to hook onto in any way. And I know he was supposed to be very difficult, but I didn't know that Viggo had written enough to make me actually care that much about him. I just thought he was a real arse. What did you think?
I have to say, I watched this film every time Lance was on screen playing Willis, just with my mouth hanging open. He's such a sort of vile, kind of bilious character, the likes of which, you know, you don't normally see in a Hollywood movie. They normally kind of water these things down. I mean, as Jamie was saying, this guy does not hold back with his insults, racial insults, homophobic insults. He's got the entire playbook, basically. And yes, he's extremely difficult to sympathise with. And I guess we should also add that he's kind of suffering, you know, quite severely from dementia as well, which does make it tragic. But he's a very hard character to warm to. But I kind of enjoyed it because of the fact that Viggo, as a, you know, writer-director, had dared put this kind of character on screen and just say, well, look, this is what people can be like. Henriksen is unbelievable in this film. I mean, I don't think he will get a nomination, not because he doesn't deserve it. I just think it's so caustic as a performance, it might be too much for voters. But we'll see. I hope he does.
He's probably the average age of people who are voting for the Oscars. No, I mean, we jest. But yes, his performance is amazing. And I don't know, I felt like I did want a little bit of that cheesy Hollywoodization just to understand where the good was, if there was any at all. And I guess I've probably answered my own question there, because it's about the fact that as a family, you just have to look after your parents, and it's not really about whether they're good people or not. It's about sort of familial love and responsibility.
For me, he was absolutely vile, like we've said, in so many ways. But I felt that Henriksen gave just enough glimmers of absolute fear of growing old, of losing his body, of losing his mind, of being uprooted. All of these things, which he's clearly terrified. And the way he shows that terror is that he just spews like vile filth and he kind of goes on the attack. And because I understood where it was coming from, I kind of just had enough compassion for him that it saw me through. Mortensen's been quite open about the fact it is based loosely on his own dad, who, it should be said, wasn't racist, wasn't homophobic, but he was very antiquated in his views towards women and their place in society. He was very controlling, inflexible, strict. You know, Mortensen's gone on the record saying all of this. And for me, it felt like a really personal film. You know, when I watched it, I didn't know the background. I didn't know the story of where it came from. But watching it, I thought this must be based on truth. It just feels like a kind of true personal story.
It's quite interesting as a film, sort of politically as well, arriving at the time of, you know, Biden ousting Trump from the White House. And in a way, it seems to sort of characterize the divisions in America at the moment, the kind of liberal side that you get on the coasts in the way you would have with Vigo's household in this story, and then the kind of more slightly prejudiced views, shall we say, that, you know, some Trump voters might have. It just seemed interesting that it seemed to crystallize what's going on in America at the moment.
I'm sure. And I think if you read any interviews that Vigo's done about this film, he's sort of drawn that parallel himself, that it does sort of speak to the current time we're living in. I think we're actually saying it is quite an interesting film because we are arguing over it. So maybe it is one that we should be highly recommending again. What would you say?
I think it's definitely worth seeing. I don't think, you know, going back to Mank, it is nowhere near that class, but it's a really good, solid film with one incredible performance in it. And it's also interesting that Viggo's been trying to make this film for 24 years. You know, he's never quite managed to raise the money. It kept falling apart. And finally, he's got it made. And then it comes out, like James says, at a very opportune time where it really chimes. So that's quite weird and unusual. But yeah, I would say give it a go. Definitely give it a go.
Okay, so it is in UK and Irish cinemas from the 4th of December. So go and have a look. Right, shall we go from LA and America to London with this one?
I know what it is to be afraid. And to feel that nothing is safe. Seem paranoid as usual. The phone rang at least 3 times tonight.
Are you okay?
Did I make you jump?
Are you safe, Frank?
What do you mean?
Am I safe with you?
Am I safe with you, Cordelia?
So this is Cordelia. James, who's Cordelia and where do we find her?
Cordelia is, first of all, played by Antonia Campbell-Hughes. We find her in London, pretty much in her flat for most of the film. She shares this flat with her twin sister, Caroline, also played by Campbell-Hughes. We don't see a great deal of Caroline. She leaves for the weekend with her boyfriend, played by Joel Fry, fairly early on in the story, leaving Cordelia herself home alone. Cordelia has an upstairs neighbour, Frank, played by Johnny Flynn, who's a cellist. They meet and Cordelia's begins to get very unsettled. The film, I think, reminds me best of something like Repulsion, where we're really seeing the inner psyche of this girl as she gradually sort of frays at the seams. We're never quite sure what sort of Frank's motivations are. What, you know, is he just a kindly neighbour or not? But gradually, the film gets darker, bleaker, as we're kind of watching her unravel, really.
This sounds darker and bleaker, very much Jamie Graham's wheelhouse.
It is very much my wheelhouse. I mean, I didn't love this movie. I think, again, it's solid. James mentioned Repulsion, and we get a lot of films that kind of riff on Repulsion, or you can see the Repulsion influence. You know, we had one, Kaleidoscope, a couple of years ago, and for me, this is a good, solid one. It's not one of the better ones. It's certainly not a patch on Repulsion, but the performances are good. You've got Johnny Flynn playing the upstairs neighbour, who very much reminded me of his role in Beast. That,
very ambiguous.
Yeah, ambiguous. He's so charming. He's such a handsome, charming man, but he has this sort of dark layer to him, or this, oh, you can't quite trust him. And throughout this film, it's like, is he on her side? Is he kind of looking after like he says he is? Or, you know, there's obviously a bit of love interest there. Or is he actually, you know, does he have a dark ulterior motive? So it plays on that quite nicely. The production design of a flat is very good, and you see other flats in the building which are all kind of dilapidated. Michael Gambon is in one scene as a neighbour who just pokes his head out the door and starts muttering about mice and rats in the building, and, you know, it kind of adds to the atmosphere. It's constantly building and building. I think it's decent. Like I said, I enjoyed it, but there's some very strong films this week, and if you're not someone who's going to watch six films in a week, if you're picking one or two, this wouldn't be in the one or two I'd pick.
Mm. What about you, James? Is it in your one or two you'd pick?
As Jamie said, it's a very strong week, so no in that sense. But it's directed by Adrian Shergold, who did Funny Cow with Maxine Peake a couple of years ago, which I thought was a fantastic film. Mm. I don't think this is quite on that level. You know, we should add that Antonia, who plays the lead, also co-wrote it with Adrian. It was actually originally developed for Sally Hawkins, and then she couldn't do it because of sort of her career kind of exploded. You know, Antonia sort of gamely stepped in and really made it her own. Like Jamie, I don't think it quite works all the way, but I think it's got a lot of interesting stuff in it. There's plenty there to chew on. It's just perhaps not quite a full meal.
It's
definitely one of those films that plays on that whole thing of kind of sanity crumbling and how much is fantasy, how much is reality blurring the boundaries. You know, it's interesting, but we have seen it many times before.
I guess the one that I'd sort of liken it to is Saint Maud, you know. Definitely. And Saint Maud is also informed by Revulsion as well, and that idea of a woman losing her grasp on reality.
Yeah.
And that's really difficult, I guess, if you're following something as excellent as Saint Maud to really compete. It's a shame, I guess, for this film that Saint Maud came out before it, because perhaps, you know, you might have thought it was better than it was had you not seen that already. However, it is available to stream, so you don't have to leave the house and you don't have to go to the cinema. So if you fancy it, it might be worth a go. Cordelia is available to stream on Apple TV, iTunes, Google Play and Amazon, and it's out now. Okay, shall we stay with the disquieting feeling then? Yes. Are you ready to get your jump scares on with this?
Have you ever done anything like this before?
I've never done this over Zoom. Obviously, we're not physically together, but there's no reason why Spirit can't communicate over the internet.
Nothing's gonna happen.
Visualize us sitting in a circle. Spirit, we invite you to use us to pass on any communication. Is there anyone there? Please come forth.
What was that? Amy, was that you?
I heard it.
No, I heard something.
I think there's something here.
Did you see that?
Emma.
Oh, funny.
Okay, so this is Host. Jamie, what's it about?
It's about five female friends who are in lockdown, and they're Zooming each other. And there's also a sick friend, a male friend, who sort of pops in and out, but he's not in the whole film, as it were. So they're Zooming each other and they're going to have a bit of fun by having a Zoom seance that one of them knows this kind of mumsy Scottish medium called Ceylan, who does these seances online. So they all settle down to do this seance. They're having a bit of a laugh about it. A couple of them don't take it seriously at all, don't believe in it, are sort of playing a few practical jokes, taking the piss. And then a couple of disquieting things start to happen. It's like, oh, this is getting a bit serious. And then from there, it builds and builds and builds. I mean, basically, it kicks off all sorts of all-out assortive terror happens. I think it's absolutely great. It was made in lockdown by Rob Savage, and he just casts these people, these five actresses who are all friends, they know each other, and you really get that sense on the Zoom meeting that there's a past history, there's a kind of dynamic there. All of these actresses, they had to film themselves in their house because it was made during lockdown, so they did their own filming, they did a lot of their own in-camera effects. The script that was sent to them was redacted, so they didn't know what was going to happen to the other characters in the film. So when the scares come and the jumps come, the reactions are completely authentic because they're not expecting it. Only the person it happens to knows. It's one of those films that is genuinely, genuinely scary. It feels really real. It's perfect for these times because we've all been in lockdown. We've all been Zooming friends.
We're Zooming now. Jamie.
We are indeed. It could kick off. And also, it's only 56 minutes and it doesn't need to be any more. It just gets in, sets it up, does the job, gets out and leaves you absolutely terrified. You know, for me, it's not only a really, really good horror film, but it's probably the defining horror film of the year in terms of it's the one we remember because it just plugs into that whole pandemic, COVID, Zooming, everything that was defined this year.
I totally agree. Yeah, it's the total COVID horror. You know, I know Ben Wheatley's made one during lockdown. We'll see what happens with that. But this one is kind of hard to beat. Did you like it, James? Were you scared?
Yeah, I have to say, Jamie had sort of warned me in advance and said, I think you said you'd seen it twice and that you were really scared both times. And I was like, nah, it's not going to be that bad. You know, it does usually take quite a lot for horror films to scare me. I mean, you know, it's got to be a certain type of film that you really kind of plug into. And yeah, I was genuinely very scared. And I think what's really clever about it is, as Jamie said, it all kicks off at a certain point. And then suddenly you've got 5-6 little windows on your screen and you're never quite sure what's going to happen to each person. So your eye is going between all 5 or 6 different boxes, which makes it even scarier because you're not just looking at one room, one set of circumstances. You're looking at 6 of them. I'll tell you how scared I was by the end of it. Obviously, we were sent sort of links to watch these things, which, you know, you sort of watch on your, you can connect on your phone or whatever and then plug it into your television. I actually deleted the link afterwards.
Like a ring. You were like, I can't watch that again. Yeah. Something terrible's going to happen. This is going to be available to stream. And if you watch it on a laptop, it's even more terrifying, especially in a darkened room. It really does chill you to the bone. Yeah, I was surprised how creepy it was.
But it came out on Shudder, which is a horror streaming channel, and it proved such a success. It's one of those movies that caught the zeitgeist. Everyone on social media was talking about it. And now, you know, a couple of months later or a few months later, they're releasing it in cinemas because it really did blow up as a phenomenon. I can never say that word. And it was just made for, you know, pennies. It's made for pennies. And off the back of this, the director, Rob Savage, he's been offered a 3-picture deal with Blumhouse Productions. His writers, Jed Shepherd and Gemma Hurley, are in on this deal as well, and his producer and editor. And, you know, they fully deserve it because this is a cracking little horror movie and Blumhouse sort of specialise in these low-budget horror movies, so it's a match in heaven.
I imagine Blumhouse are like, why did we not think of this? And this is no sort of disrespect to them. It feels really obvious. Why, of course, hasn't anyone done this? It's genius. It's, you know, it taps into everything that we're feeling at the moment. So yeah, I can well understand why Blumhouse would want that talent on their books.
I was going to say, it's not the first time we've seen a sort of, let's call it, computer screen movie. Yeah, there's been like Searching as an example. There was Unfriended.
Spree one as well.
Yeah.
And there's actually a very good one called Profile, which never came out in the UK, which was excellent. But this is the best example I've seen of those types of movies. I mean, particularly as you see at the top and the bottom of the screen, you see the zoom sort of functions all the way through the film. So you're constantly looking at something we've all been looking at this year, which just adds to the reality of it, I think.
Yeah, it really feels in-world, doesn't it?
The genius of it is that, like James said, it's been done before, and even not talking desktop movies, but, you know, go back to just found footage horror movies, going back to Cannibal Holocaust in 1980, Blair Witch, Paranormal Activity. It's all been done before ad nauseum. There's hundreds of found footage horror movies, but this one takes it and it gives it a real fresh lick of paint and makes it right here, right now. And it's so well put together. You know, it's a great little film. Highly, highly recommend it.
Okay, so that's Host, and it is released in cinemas and on digital platforms on the 4th of December. I kind of recommend seeing that on a laptop, which I don't usually say about films, but actually that one is super creepy on a laptop. Okay, let's shake it off. Ugh, let's get rid of that creepy feeling and let's go to this one.
I used to work for some older guy when I was your age. Running errands, things like that. I had to be the man of the house. Help my mum out.
Bye, kids.
Bye. I'm the man of my house.
Talk to me, T. What's up? How are things at home?
That's what being a man's about, dealing with stress. And you deal with stress.
Yo, it's Jim's line. We've got that, crack cocaine, heroin. We've got everything there, so you need to send a text as quick.
Do you have any idea what you have to do to get that money? The risks that are involved?
Tony, you got to wake up.
So this is County Lines. James, tell us what this is about.
Well, County Lines, first of all, we should say, is a well-known, well, it wasn't particularly well-known to me, but a well-known phenomenon in Britain of sort of drug running, let's say, between urban environments and you know, towns and rural areas across the country, where basically drug dealers kind of recruit young drug runners, you know, usually teenagers that, you know, coming from a poor, disenfranchised kind of background. They flash some cash at them and, you know, eventually these kids are kind of recruited into this kind of world. And that's exactly what the film, written and directed by Henry Blake, it shows. And, you know, it does it in a very kind of social realistic fashion. Here we have Tyler, played by newcomer Conrad Khan, who is a kind of 14-year-old. His mother works a kind of night shift job. And he's kind of almost the man of the household, really, or at least he thinks he is. And he's recruited by Simon, who's played by Harris Dickinson, who you'll probably know from the Danny Boyle TV drama Trust, where he played the kidnapped John Paul Getty III. And
he's in Beach Rats as well.
He is in Beach Rats, yes.
He's very good in that.
And he's coming up in The Kingsman, the prequel to the Kingsman films. So, yes, Simon sort of recruits Tyler, and then it's really Tyler's journey through this world and kind of what happens to him. Pretty obviously, it doesn't necessarily always end well.
No, and it's quite bleak. Is it worth watching, though?
I did like it. It has that almost sort of Ken Loach feel about it. We should add that Henry Blake is originally from New Zealand, and he's lived in the UK for a number of years now. And he worked in sort of, I think, through charity organisations with vulnerable children. So he's got incredible experience in this world. You know, he's met children, teenagers, just like Tyler in the film. And so there's a lot of authenticity in the movie. It is a bleak watch for sure. I did enjoy it. But again, as we were saying earlier, there are so many strong films this week. It probably isn't the strongest of the week. But again, as a first film, it's built also from a short that he made a few years ago. And it's kind of been expanded out from that. And I think as a directorial debut, it's very sound. I mean, I'm very curious to see what he does next.
What about you, Jamie?
I agree with everything James said. That I think it's a strong debut. Want to see what he does next. Not one of the absolute best films of a very strong week. But, you know, it is good and it's compelling. And like you said, it's very miserable in that kind of British yes. social realist way, whether it's Ken Loach, Alan Clark, Neil by Mouth, you know, it's those are the kind of touchstones. And what I liked about it is we've seen many films set in this kind of drug trafficking world where they play it for genre thrills and you can have it quite dynamic and quite exciting, and this one kind of strips all that away. And when he delivers drugs, you know, he goes into a crack den at one point and he sees someone shoot up, and it's just authentic and heartfelt and gritty and real. A talent to watch, I would say, for director Henry Blake.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't glamorize this world. I definitely think he nails that credibility, authenticity in a very, very, you know, perfect way.
And that sort of ease with which kids are recruited and the offer that is made to them, and the fact that, you know, this stepping over the line into sort of illegality is very easy for a kid that age with that background.
This kid, Tyler, he's 14 years old and he's bullied at school. His mum is rarely in the house. She's either working night shifts or she's out finding a new date. He has to care for his little sister. You know, he again uses the M word. He's got a pretty miserable life. And all it takes is he bumps into this guy, into Simon, who's very charismatic. And Simon steps in to stop him being bullied and then buys him a burger and chips and some trainers. And that's pretty much all it takes. You know, this kid has had no like male figure in his life, no one to kind of steer him. Next thing you know, he's in the business, and then things get really grim. And suddenly you realise this older guy is not your friend. And when he has to be horrible, he's going to be really, really horrible.
So let's just let people know where they can see that if they want to have, as you say, a bit of misery in their lives, but classy misery. It's well done. County Lines is released in cinemas and digitally on BFI Player and Curzon Home Cinema on the 4th of December. So have a go on that if you fancy it. Shall we move on to our final film then?
Yeah.
And it's completely different. It's this one.
To make great music, a good musician has to put music before everything. And that's what I've always done.
Good
God looked down on this little cottage in Ireland and said, that little boy there, he's the little boy that I'm going to use to save Irish music.
Shay went to London when we were 13.
I love the drinks, the gigs, the girls.
The lyrics are always about fighting, drinking, dying, living. You know, the things that everybody does.
Okay, so this is Croc of Gold. Jamie, what is the Croc of Gold and who is it about?
Well, it's directed by Julian Temple, who we know has done many music documentaries, you know, has a kind of punk background, and this is a perfect fit. But it's about Shane McGowan, who's the frontman of the Pogues, the Irish band the Pogues. And it's very much a kind of a documentary looking at his whole life from when he was a kid growing up in poverty in Ireland, when Ireland was still very much a British colony. And then kind of it just follows him as he gets into punk, he goes to London, you know, he forms this band, the Pogues. He's very informed by other kind of Irish writers and poets, has a very strong sense of Irish culture. He wants to take this Irish music, kind of mix it with punk and get it out there into the world. You know, he's a bit like Johnny Ross in that he's a very kind of angry young man. I went into this film knowing very, very little about the Pogues and about Shane McGowan, that I knew Fairy Tale of New York, like we all do, you know. It's actually probably my favourite Christmas song.
Yeah,
but it's
certainly
been so...
that's about this time of year, isn't it?
But it's been so overplayed, but we all know that one. Dirty Old Town, I knew. You know, I knew a couple of the songs, but I didn't know anything about them. So I found it really interesting just to kind of get to know this guy and what kind of drives him and his politics and where it all came from. It's got loads of great archive footage, you know, when it's going back to the 80s, 70s, 80s in London, and you've got punk gigs and people kicking off, you know. It's got a fantastic energy to it. The only thing I'll say is it very much relies on Shane McGowan to kind of narrate the story. There's a lot of interviews with him and him kind of saying it. And he's now, you know, he's getting older. He's had a hard life of booze and cigarettes. He's in a wheelchair, and you know, he's not the most dynamic talker anymore, and he kind of is almost inaudible in places. So I found some of it I was kind of straining to hear and to follow it, but apart from that, you know, I thought it was really good, really compelling documentary.
Are you a Pogues fan, James?
No, exactly like Jamie, I think the Irish Rover was another one I could remember, but that's about it. And I got to say, I came into this film, you know, having watched the first sort of few minutes and thinking, why am I watching this? Why should I be interested in this guy? I know very little about him. As Jamie said, he's not the most compelling talker now because of the sort of physical problems he's had recently, let's say. And yet, as the story went on, I really got into it and I was quite moved by the end of it, which I was quite surprised at. As Jamie said, it's Julian Temple, who's, if you're going to have someone directing a music biopic, that's pretty much who you want. And I guess because of the fact that Temple did Great Rock and Roll Swindle and Filth and the Fury, he has this huge connection to the Sex Pistols. And there's a great overlap with Shane attending Sex Pistols concerts and so forth. And that, you know, it just feels like Temple is exactly the right director to be making this film. You know, we should add that there's, I suppose, cameo appearances, if that's what you want to say, of Johnny Depp, who's a friend of his and also a producer on the film. Jerry Adams of Sin fame, which I was quite shocked about initially. I was like, God, that's quite controversial, giving him sort of airtime. But, you know, he clearly knows McGowan well. And, you know, McGowan had, you know, strong IRA connections and beliefs, we should probably say. So you had to have someone like that in there. Those weren't ignored or, you know, swept under the carpet. So, yeah, I think, it, you know, it really did work as a film because it went through everything, basically. Yeah. It didn't leave any stone unturned.
Yeah, it's very clear-eyed in looking at him, isn't it? There's no sort of blurring around the edges or dressing anything up.
Yeah.
It's not even sort of saying that he's a really great singer, because he really kind of isn't, but it's more about that poetic soul and that drive and the intention of what his music does and what his music says that is really, really interesting. And yeah, like you guys, if the Fairy Tale of New York is your entry point into this, it's fascinating to go down this road and find out all of the things that informed that performance eventually on Top of the Pops that we probably all saw. I can remember watching that on Top of the Pops and thinking, why isn't this guy trying harder? Why isn't he more excited? And this is the answer why, you know, like to really understand his background, where he came from, the troubles that he lived through, really makes me understand that Top of the Pops performance that I saw. So I really enjoyed it.
Like James said, it kind of shows every side of Shane McGowan, and it's completely unvarnished, and his music is unvarnished. You know, it has that kind of outlaw, down and dirty spirit. So whatever your feelings on whether that song should be kind of tweaked or not, this is a fascinating documentary and will probably give you a bit more background to make your judgments.
Indeed.
The only thing I didn't really like was the sort of dramatic recreations. As Jamie said, the archive is absolutely staggering. I mean, they do an incredible job, but presumably there were certain bits they just couldn't find archive for. And they have sort of misty-eyed black and white shots of young boys running through church graveyards and things like that, which didn't really do it for me. But luckily, that's only a small part of the film.
I didn't mind it. I thought it just kept it all rolling along quite nicely, quite lively. I do think it's a bit strange, though, to sort of open with Johnny Depp Presents and have Johnny Depp pop up several times just right now, again, talking of current climate, where he's just kind of been dropped from the Fantastic Beasts franchise and stuff. It's maybe not the best timing.
But it's kind of fitting in that sort of give a stuff attitude that,
of course,
saying that in a much more polite way, that sort of Shane McGowan has and that the Pogues sort of represent. So for that rebel spirit and not complying with social norms or expectations, then I guess then it does work. Okay, so that is Crock of Gold, which is released in UK and Irish cinemas on December the 4th and is available on DVD and digital from December the 7th. Before we go then, that was our week. Shall we pick one pot of gold out of that you would highly recommend people because it's a great week? Which one is your number one?
If I had to pick one, just as in the film that will stand the test of time and is the kind of greatest film with a capital G out of them, it would have to be Mank. But I really don't want to pick one because I want to say Mank and Host, as in Host is such a tiny little film made for 5p, but so effective. So I'd say give them both a go.
Okay, James?
Yeah, I kind of got to agree, really. Mank is the obvious choice because it's a supreme work of art, but I'm going to recommend Host just because it was the film that surprised me the most this week.
Yeah, agreed. I would say Host, and also because who doesn't love a film that's an hour long? You know, I love a fast and furious film that just gets me scared and then makes me not want to do Zoom. Okay, so finally, before we go, we do have a reader's question. Are you ready?
Yeah.
What question do you dread an interviewee asking you?
There's only one answer to that.
Yeah, I think we probably all have the same answer. Yeah.
Did you like the film?
Yeah, every time.
Yeah, and what do you say if you really don't like the film when somebody who has directed it, acted in it, spent years of their life making it, asks you that?
I think I use my go-to euphemism, which was, it's really interesting, but then you don't want to say too much because then you might start digging yourself into holes. It's actually quite rare, though, I've found in all the interviews I've done, for people to actually blatantly ask you what you thought of the film. I think they all know better not to. I tend to find if I really do like a film, it's kind of just blurts out at the beginning of an interview anyway.
Yeah.
And then otherwise, let's just leave that thorny topic alone.
What about you, Jamie? What's your response when someone asks you that?
Well, I'm the same. That if I love a film, I tend to say it up top, and I don't say it to blow smoke up their ass. I just say it because I want to say it, that I go in and sort of say, love the film, by the way, blah, blah, blah. When they ask me when I don't like it, I've had this a few times. Usually, like James, I'll sort of fudge it a bit and sort of say, oh, yeah, it was really interesting, or, oh, you know, it seemed to play really well, you know, the audience. I sort of deflect it. I have told this story before, but I'll tell it again. The one time I was brutally honest was with Josh Brolin. I sat down for the interview and the first thing he said to me, it was for that, I can never remember
Labor
the
Day.
Name. Labor Day, you see, I have told this story before.
I know, and it's one of your chestnuts.
Yeah, he said, what did you think of the film? And he sort of fixed me with that glare of his. And I just sort of judged it that he seems a no-nonsense, no-bullshit man. So I was honest and I said, wasn't really for me. You know, I found it a bit sentimental. I thought you and Kate Winslet were both great in it, that you sort of did what you could and brought authenticity. But, you know, it's not one of the finest films I've seen. And he just shook me very strongly by the hand and he said exactly what I think you and I are going to get on very well. And it was almost like a test, but it could have backfired horribly. He could have got up and walked out. So, you know.
Yeah. So just don't be honest. Yeah. I generally say to people, I think audiences will love it. All films find an audience. There will be an audience that loves it, but it isn't me.
I'm going to use that one in the future. That's a good one.
So you're not lying. You're just not being truthful either. That is always the question that we dread. So let's hope we don't get that in our next batch of interviews. Okay, it's time to say goodbye then. So please remember that Total Film is out on sale with Mank on the cover, with a big deep dive into the making of that. So if you fancy reading more about that film when you've seen it on Netflix, do seek it out. And in the meantime, we will be back next week. But for now, let's say goodbye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Goodbye, boys. Bye, everyone. The boys of the Christmas Day.